Good morning, everyone. Good to see everyone made it through what I hope was our last snow of the year. We have a very important matter to take up before we hear the cases of the day, however, and I will turn it over to my brother, Ken Ripple.
Well, thank you, Judge Williams. I have a motion for admission to the bar. If Ms. Ray would please come to the podium. Judge Williams and Judge St. Eve, I have the honor this morning to move the admission of my law clerk, Ms. Allison A. Ray. Ms. Ray is a member of the bar of the state of Illinois, a graduate of Harvard College and of Harvard Law School. She has already clerked for our colleague, Judge Pallmeyer, in the district court, and is completing very successfully a year in my chambers. And she plans to practice here in the state of Illinois after she leaves the court. So I'm honored to move her admission to the bar.
And this is an easy grant, Judge Ripple. So I'm happy to grant the admission of Allison Ray and welcome you to the bar of the Seventh Circuit. And know, based on the endorsement you've received from Judge Ripple and all the hard work and all your accomplishments, that you will contribute greatly to the bar of the state of Illinois and to equal justice. Thank you, Ms. Ray.
Thank you.
Congratulations. And we'll now go to the first case of the day, Hahn versus Walsh, 13-1766. Mr. Flaxman.
May it please the court. This case presents the question that was flagged by the court in Shields versus Illinois Department of Corrections, which is whether that respondeat superior applies to corporations who are engaged in acting under color of law and allegedly deprive someone of the rights, privileges, or immunities guaranteed by the Constitution or laws of the United States. In Vodak versus City of Chicago, the court acknowledged that scholars were in agreement that the Supreme Court got it wrong in Monell in reading the legislative history, that the legislative history is clear to the uniform view of scholars, as the court said, that respondeat superior was commonplace at the time 1983 was enacted, and that the reasons given by the court for finding that there was no respondeat superior from municipal corporations are historically inaccurate, incorrect.
Before we get into that, as I understand it, you didn't name the nurses as defendants in this action. You didn't file a claim for respondeat superior, and the court never considered that issue. So why should we reconsider the application of Monell to private corporations?
The court did consider that issue when it applied the accepted and ordinary rule that the only way to get liability for a corporation is by its policies, not by suing individuals. It's I think the rule that we're relying on is that when a district court makes a ruling, that ruling can be appealed.
But did you challenge it on this basis below? You did not.
No, it was not raised in the district court.
So have you waived it by not raising it below?
We have not waived it because the rule that we're relying on is that when the district judge decides something, even if it's not raised before him or her, it can be appealed. It's part of the decision.
But if you didn't raise it before the judge and the judge didn't have the opportunity to address it, why should we take it up?
Because if the court had an opportunity to address it, the district judge would have said, I have to follow Iskander. And the 10 cases that came after it would say that the same Monell standard of policy applies to claims against corporations that apply to claims against municipalities. And I can't overrule the Seventh Circuit. Go talk to them. You're just wasting your time here.
Yeah, but if you get that answer, then at least you preserve the issue, because that's the problem I'm having with your argument.
Well, I think I understand. I'm not seeking to minimize that problem, and the principle that I'm relying on is that if the district judge rules on something, it's folly, I think was the language that the court used in a case called U.S. versus City of Chicago. It's folly to say that you can't appeal that ruling, even if it had not been litigated before the district judge. You can appeal from whatever the ruling is of a district court. I'll be glad to supply the citation for that case and the case that came after it, which applied that rule in a post-argument supplement. That's the same question that's at issue in the rehearing petition in Shields versus Illinois Department of Corrections, where the issue wasn't raised until it came out in the opinion, and now in the rehearing petition, the appellant is arguing that it doesn't matter because it would have been futile.
Well, let's move to the motion to dismiss issue. You never provided an affidavit in the 6 months between when you filed the initial complaint and when you filed the motion to amend the court's decision. So why was the court's decision to dismiss an abuse of discretion?
Because
under Illinois law, you're required to do that, right?
Our primary argument is that Illinois law does not apply to this action pending in federal court. There's a direct collision between the requirement of 2-622 that you submit an affidavit and a report attached to a complaint with Rule 11A of the Rules of Civil Procedure. In a case called Frazana K versus Indiana Department of Education, which is cited in the reply brief, this court rejected an Indiana statute which required that a particular type of complaint be supported with an affidavit. The court said that Rule 11A, which says that you don't need to file affidavits or documents unless required by law, applies only to federal law, and the state law collides with Rule 11A, and there's no reason why the Rules Enabling Act is unconstitutional as applied to this, so you do not have to follow the Indiana requirement. The Illinois requirement is precisely the same. You have to file an affidavit by an attorney and support that with a report from the physician or the healthcare provider. What's odd about this case is that when the complaint was filed, there was a particular statute in effect in Illinois. That statute was later held unconstitutional in the Illinois Supreme Court, so we have to go back to the earlier statute, which did not require that you identify the name of the doctor who gave the opinion. And the earlier statute also allowed the plaintiff to voluntarily dismiss his or her lawsuit and then refile it a year later in complying with the 2-622 requirement.
Yeah, but I mean, the heart of your argument is that 2-622 and Rule 11 somehow conflict, and I'm even having trouble seeing how there's a real conflict here. There's an additional obligation under 2-622, but there's not really a conflict.
I think if you, Honor, looks at the second sentence of Rule 11A, which expressly prohibits any requirement to file affidavits or documents with a complaint, we have that express collision. And it's what the court said in Frazana when it had a different kind of affidavit. I don't know how the court could, of course, disavow Frazana, could say that it's wrong, but I think that as long as it's the law of the circuit, we're stuck with it. And it directly collides.
Mr. Flaxman, doesn't Hines, the Seventh Circuit's opinion, lend guidance here, even though it dealt with an Indiana statute that required submission of a medical malpractice claim to a medical review panel first? Doesn't that guide or control here?
No, it guides, and it doesn't control. It guides because there's no conflict between a pre-suit submission process where you have to get a panel to say it's a meritorious claim. No, that's nothing like that in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That's part of the state cause of action, that you must have these people say it's an okay case to go. The Illinois requirement doesn't require submission to another panel. It just requires that you submit an affidavit from the attorney, which collides with Rule 11A, supported with a report from a physician who's named.
In your briefs before this court, you also appear to be arguing that the Illinois statute violates or conflicts with Rule 8. Did you raise that argument before the district court?
No. The district court applied his rule that if you don't submit the 622 affidavit and certificate with your complaint or within the statute of limitations, your cause of action is time barred.
I understand what the court ruled, but in trying to persuade him otherwise, did you also raise the conflict with Rule 8 before the district judge?
Okay. No. The argument is made more elegantly here than it was in the district court.
Thank you.
And then in terms of some other arguments that you didn't make, your arguments relating to the HPL's policies, you don't cite any case law, the specific policies, or provide any analysis about how those policies are unconstitutional. Why aren't those arguments waived?
I thought I cited two cases, a Sixth Circuit case and a Ninth Circuit case in the opening brief, which had analogous situations where there was no policy for somebody who was dying, and the courts, both cases, reversed the grants of summary judgment. I thought I don't.
But those cases are not really applicable here, are they?
I think they're deciding the same 14th Amendment standard of deliberate indifference to a serious medical need that's at issue in this case. And I think of course, decisions from other circuits are not controlling, but I think they're instructive about the law that should be applied here. I'm looking for, at page 28 of Appellant's brief, we cite Blackmore versus Kalamazoo County, a Sixth Circuit case where the correctional officers ignored complaints of stomach pains, which turned out to be appendicitis. And then we also cite a Ninth Circuit case, Long versus County of Los Angeles, another grant of summary judgment that was reversed because there was no policy about what to do when an inmate refuses essential medical treatment such as oxygen. This is a case where the policy, as the evidence came in the summary judgment record, is that if you have a broken AccuCheck machine, which I think is a fair inference if it registers E, and the patient or the detainee doesn't want to submit to further finger pricks on the broken machine, you can let them die. You don't have to take them to a doctor. You don't have to even call a doctor. You just say, well, you're refusing treatment and you can die.
You arguing that the sheriff has no policy relating to individuals who refuse treatment? Or are you arguing that the sheriff needs to have a specific policy relating to diabetic individuals whose blood sugar was not being measured and who refused to eat?
It's neither one of those. It's more of a second than the third, because I don't think you can say that Ms. Hahn refused treatment. She refused to submit to a broken machine. That's not treatment. That's just doing a useless act. Nobody ever looked into why is that machine registering E or ER? Did the batteries need to be replaced? Is the machine broken? Should we take this woman to the emergency room?
So give me as precise terms as you can exactly the policy that you're saying was not in existence.
The policy of the sheriff, the sheriff's policy was just to sit back and do nothing and let the woman die. They knew that the machine wasn't working. The sheriff knew that the woman had been there before, that she was an insulin-dependent diabetic. They knew that insulin-dependent diabetics need their insulin or they're going to die. And they knew this woman wasn't getting any. And their policy
was... Mr. Flaxman, are you arguing then that the serious medical need at issue here was her diabetic condition or the risk of suicide?
I don't think... No, it's a diabetic condition. I don't think there's a suicide here. I think that the woman was confused. She was deprived of her psychotropic medication pursuant to a policy of HPL that allows a non-psychiatrist or non-doctor to say, I don't think you need Seroquel because you told me it's for sleep. She was confused. I don't think she was committing suicide. She was confused, and she wasn't being given any treatment. They weren't testing her blood sugar with the machine that worked.
What about the fact that the record is full of evidence that she refused food and the impact that had on her condition.
Well, I think that goes, that supports our claim that she refused food, that it's, I think the sheriff and HPL knew that if a diabetic isn't eating, she's more at risk to die, to get sick. That when the HPL policy is that a diabetic comes in, is a type 1 diabetic, who's insulin dependent, is not to find out what insulin she's taking or how often she takes it or what her regimen is, but to put her on this sliding scale with a broken AccuCheck machine. And when there's expert opinion that that's so far away from any kind of treatment that it's no treatment, that it's the kind of thing that kills someone.
And going back to the AccuCheck machine, what evidence do you have that the sheriff knew that that machine was problematic other than the incident in question here, that he was put on notice that broken machines were used or that HPL was put on notice?
We don't know it was problematic. We know it was broken, and the sheriff's people knew it was broken, and the sheriff's policy is if the machine is broken.
And when did they know it was broken? That's part of what I want to get to.
When they, I think it's...
When they checked her, right?
And it read E, right?
Right. And so what I want to know is, in terms of notice, you know, so that's the first instance you're aware of or that's in the record that machine was not functioning properly.
But going back, the sheriff didn't have a policy for what happens when the machine breaks. They didn't have a spare machine. They didn't have a technician. They didn't have any instruction manual as far as we can tell. They just said, if it's E, well, tell HPL, and if HPL doesn't do anything, well, that's their problem, not our problem. The sheriff is responsible for the people who come into the jail who can't go out and see their doctor and has an obligation to do more than sit back and let them die, which is what happened here.
Mr. Flaxman, in the district court, with respect to HPL's policies, I can see where there were three arguments made, and you've made those three arguments here on appeal, with respect to the obtaining of medical records, the policy of administering insulin, policy on ignoring erroneous readings from the blood monitoring machine. And what I hear you making here now is an argument really that it was the cumulative effect of these policies that really was inimical to your client. Am I correct?
Yes.
Where did you make that argument in the district court?
The district court pleadings are very unfocused, and I'm not sure how clearly it was made.
Okay. May I ask you, while you're here, to also address your second argument with respect to the amendment of the complaint?
Well, the district judge has a rule that you cannot amend a complaint to add the 2-622 certificate and affidavit if the statute of limitations is run. And there are some states that actually have that kind of requirement, that if you don't file the certificate by the time the statute of limitations is run, then you lose. I think that's the Florida statute. Illinois doesn't have that. Illinois applies relation back. What if Mrs. Hahn or her administrator had filed this complaint just with deliberate indifference and after 3 years of litigation had discovered a basis for maintaining a medical malpractice claim, and she sought leave to file an amended complaint and complied with 2-622. That would seem that it would be governed by the relation back of Rule 15 rather than by anything in Illinois law. And the district judge is, I think, the only judge in Illinois who has adopted that strict rule, and that's another reason for why the case should be reversed and remanded on the medical negligence claim. But there's enough evidence in the record with
Mr.
the
Flaxman,
expert.
One of the reasons that you claim you didn't amend the complaint below was you didn't have the medical records, and you had attempted to obtain them through FOIA. Is there any evidence in the record that plaintiff made any other efforts to obtain the medical records so the complaint could have been amended?
There's nothing in the record, but the records were obtained in the course of the litigation. Expert reports were secured and tendered in the course of the litigation, and I think there would have been certainly enough to show the district judge that an amendment to add a medical malpractice claim would not have been futile. But that motion could not be made because of the district court's rule that if you don't do this before the statute runs, it's too late.
When during the course of the complaint or during the course of the case were the medical records obtained?
I don't know.
All right, Mr. Flaxman, if you want to save some time for rebuttal.
I do. Thank
all
you
right.
very much. Ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. Unrath.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Craig Unrath, and I represent the defendants appellees. This court has identified a number of waiver issues in this case. I submit that waiver pervades almost every aspect of this case, although these days I have to wonder about the vitality of the doctrine. It seems to be that courts are willing to accept all sorts of arguments that have never been raised below. At least that's been my experience lately. Here we have the
section. In this court?
Not this court, Your Honor. Shields would be an example. In Shields, the argument was that counsel referred to was never raised in the district court, nor had it been raised on appeal in any of the briefs. And yet this court has now set that for a petition for rehearing en banc, I believe, to discuss an issue that had never been raised by any of the parties. Getting back to the Section 2-622, counsel acknowledged implicitly that 2-622 applied to this case in their complaint. They made an allegation in their complaint that the reason that they did not comply with Section 2-622 is that they were had not yet received a response from a Freedom of Information Act request. Now,
but he also is making the argument that the Illinois Healing Act, the Illinois Healing Malpractice Act affidavit requires a plaintiff to do something above and beyond the complaint, and that that is in conflict with the Supreme Court's rulings in Twombly and Iqbal and not proper here in federal court.
They raise a number of issues involving Rule 8 and Rule 11.
Why don't you address that question that I asked?
In Rule 8, the Chapman decision addressed that. The court found that that Iqbal was not offended by requiring parties to comply with Section 2-622. They may still make a short, plain, concise statement of their claim, stating that they are entitled to a verdict in their favor, and that there is no violence to that rule done by merely asking that they comply with the substantive law of Illinois, which requires a physician to state that there is at least a meritorious cause of action. As to Rule 11, the argument raised below was that Rule 11 protects defendants from frivolous lawsuits. The problem with that is that Rule 11 places the burden upon the defendant to prove that the claim is non-meritorious and beyond non-meritorious, that it's absolutely frivolous, which I believe is a completely different standard. Anyway,
Mr. Unrath, in Rule 11, how do you get around the Seventh Circuit's opinion in Farazan that said that the reference to an affidavit specifically provided for in a statute refers to a federal statute, whereas here we're talking about a state statute?
I believe that we're dealing with the difference between a substantive law and procedural, and I think that this court in particular has been very clear that statutory laws limited to a particular area of law and motivated by concerns about the potential impact on primary behavior constitutes substantive law. Therefore, it must be followed.
But how does that get you around Farazan and Rule 11?
Farazan requires an affidavit from the attorney on procedural matters, and more accurately states that such an affidavit is not required. Nevertheless, you still have a substantive area of law here, and that's what gets you beyond that. In terms of the denial for leave to amend, one last point I would like to make. Counsel has made one accurate argument in their brief. They've identified a conflict in the lower courts in terms of whether 2-622 should apply. The vast weight of authority holds that there is no such conflict, that Sherrod implicitly finds that 2-622 should apply. I think it would help the give direction to the lower courts if this court clarified that rule. I believe that this court's decision in Hines, which adopted or which held that the Indiana Medical Malpractice Act is substantive law that must be applied in federal courts, is dispositive of the issue before this court. This court's clarification on that issue, I think, would be valuable. Moving on to the denial for leave to amend. Here, I believe that it's essential that the court take into account prior litigation history. The very same counsel representing plaintiffs, very same defense counsel, very same magistrate judge and district court judge dealt with this very same issue in 2007. They argued that 2-622 should not apply. Judge McCuskey ruled against them on that and dismissed their claim without prejudice and said, we're going to give you a chance to amend your complaint and set a deadline. That deadline expired, and long afterwards they came back and said, well, we'd like additional time to comply with 2-622. And he denied that. He said, no, the deadline was set. This was when you had to file your amended complaint. He dismissed the action with prejudice. So what you have here is you have the same counsel in this case knew that this court, and in particular this judge, would dismiss their wrongful death claim. They knew that without a doubt. They also knew that that dismissal could very well be with prejudice.
What prejudice would your client have suffered if the dismissal had been without prejudice and the plaintiff could have repled?
The fact that we had already expended considerable sums in litigating this case through discovery and motions to dismiss. 2-622 is designed to satisfy the meritoriousness of the case at the very earliest possible stage.
But if you had already spent the money on discovery, what prejudice would you have suffered?
Prejudice here is a prejudice to the law itself. It encourages counsel to continue to do this in the future. We have substantive statutory law laying out clear requirements. Most of all, and this is the point I was getting at based on prior history, counsel did not merely fail to comply due to some technical non-compliance. If they had, the weight of authority would clearly support allowing them an opportunity to amend. Here we have something completely different. Here what we have is willful non-compliance. They knew that this case, that count would be dismissed. They knew that it could be done with prejudice, and yet they refused to comply with the statute. And they refused to comply even on the most basic level. They had letters of administration filed 6 months after Ms. Hahn's death, and yet they took no action to obtain those medical records.
What does the record show about when they obtained those medical records?
The record is unclear. My understanding is that they were provided through discovery, but I do not have that information for you.
Did they receive them 5 months after the initial filing? Do you know if that's true?
I believe that's true, but I would have to double check.
But no affidavit was filed along with the motion to change the judgment or alter the judgment, right?
No, there was not. There was not. And the point here, Your Honor, is that this was not a technical non-compliance. This is not some fault of their that they could not have taken care of on their own. What we have here is a complete and utter lack of diligence in complying with the statute, even though they've even acknowledged in their complaint that the statute applies. Another point here is that they filed a Freedom of Information Act request in order to get these medical records. Why? Why would they do such a thing? Number one, it's not in compliance with the statute. Under the statute, they have to file subpoenas under Section 8-2001, Examination of Health Records is the title of that statute. Why didn't they follow that? Why didn't they have Mr. Hahn sign documents to have those records obtained? Why did they? We know that they were involved in this case 6 months after her death. Why
is it clear that they didn't do that? I couldn't tell from the record if Mr. Hahn had signed something to try to obtain the records earlier.
I'm not aware of anything either. And my question is, why not? Why didn't they do this? This is a complete and utter lack of diligence on their part to comply with the statute. And I think that Judge McCuskey correctly viewed this as a willful noncompliance with the statute. Now, the law in Illinois is very clear that where the court takes the facts and circumstances into consideration before determining that the complaint should be dismissed with prejudice, well, then there is no abuse of discretion. Abuse of discretion, as I pointed out in my brief, is a very high standard. In this case, I believe that Judge McCuskey followed that standard. He looked at exactly what had done here. He saw the day they filed their complaint. They filed it on the day before the statute of limitations ran. Under the statute, they had a right to immediately ask for 90 days extra. They didn't do it. They made no attempt to do that at all. The limitations period had passed. Defendants have a right to rely on limitations periods. We submit that Judge McCuskey did not abuse his discretion. Moving on to the failure to implement specific policies, plaintiff's counsel has offered a grocery list of policies that may or may not have improved medical services at the jail. However, he fails to allege or argue any causal link between any of these policies and her actual death. There's only one policy he identifies that arguably has any connection at all with her death, and that's the that they had apparently no written policy for diabetics who refused medical care and refused to eat. Well, that's the argument that they've made, and it is plainly untrue. We do have a policy. The HPL has a policy, and that policy is used by the jail.
Today, counsel said he's really arguing that it was the cumulative effect of HPL's lack of policy that really caused the situation where this lady was allowed to linger in the jail without adequate medical attention until she was really an extremist.
That argument was never made below, number one. Number two, I don't know that we can have the accumulation of these policies makes any difference because none of them have any causal link to her death. Now, take, for example, the defective AccuCheck machine. As I understand it, it was user error. The machine still worked. There is no evidence in the record suggesting that they were incapable from that point forward of obtaining...
Does the record affirmatively reflect it was user error?
I believe it does. All I know is that the correctional staff notified medical staff, and medical staff was confident enough to use that AccuCheck machine or try to use it. They tried, she refused. That's as best I can tell from the record.
Sheriff Walsh, in his declaration, is the one who addressed that they had a policy on how to handle inmates who refused water and food. But was that in writing anywhere? The other policies at issue, there was evidence below that they were in writing and in the manual. It was unclear if this one was in writing anywhere or if it's just based on the sheriff's declaration.
It's actually in writing. And as I pointed out in my brief, it is one of the most long-winded, poorly written. I tried to paraphrase it in my brief, and I just couldn't do it.
Where is it in writing? Is it in the manual?
It is in the manual.
Or some other place?
And that manual was filed under seal in the district court, and I believe that seal has been lifted by this court. If I may be allowed to paraphrase, and I'll try to do this. Again, you need to refer to my brief. I believe it's written, reproduced three different times in the brief. But it comes down to this.
Well, perhaps you could point us to the page in the brief,
you could
at least one of the three.
Turn to page 31, second full paragraph, where it starts, however, if it comes to the attention of the sheriff's employee or correctional medical or mental health worker, then an inmate or pretrial detainee following that person's refusal to accept food, water, and or necessary medical treatment prescribed by the medical professional on staff and who has subsequently developed signs or symptoms of a physical or mental distress associated with that inmate's self-imposed deprivation must be given the thing that the inmate slash pretrial detainee has refused in order to halt or reverse that person's deteriorating medical or mental condition. Then the inmate or pretrial detainee will be taken to the emergency room of the local hospital. And you can find that in the sheriff's manual. I'm going to take a stab at paraphrasing that. I'm going to tell you that when a patient, when an inmate shows signs of medical distress or mental distress as a result of refusing medication or food, then the jail will take her to the emergency room. I believe that that's what it says. It's just don't trust my paraphrase. I think it's also important to point out that this situation has never occurred in the past, and that a single violation of a policy cannot be the basis of Section 1983 liability. I see I'm running out of time.
And those other six deaths that he alluded to, there's been no tie-in to a diabetic issue, correct?
None at all. He also mentioned the drug Seroquel. I note that a number of courts will turn to the Internet for information on medicinal drugs. At least I've seen this in a number of reported decisions. Look up Seroquel. What you'll find is that Seroquel has a side effect. It increases blood sugar. It can cause hyperglycemia. It can also be used as a sleep aid or for other treatments. I think that's one point that was left out, that it does have a very serious side effect that could have had a huge impact on this, the jail's decision not to give her that medication. Finally, we have the issue of the limiting Monell to apply only to governmental bodies. I've read Judge Hamilton's argument in the Shields case. I take issue with any number of points that he raised. However, should this court decide to address that issue, I respectfully ask the opportunity to supply this court with a full briefing on the matter. I believe that there is a numerous contrary authority that to put me into a position now of having to argue for the first time an oral argument why Monell should be applied to both governmental and private enterprises, I believe is a little bit unfair. The fact remains that under the law as it stands now, it does apply to private corporations. I believe that law is well-reasoned, and should this court have any question about that, I'd appreciate the opportunity to brief it. If there are no further questions from the court, we urge you to affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Unrath. Mr. Flaxman, how much time? 2 minutes, Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you. We talked about waiver. We just had an example of waiver. In appellant's opening brief, we set out fairly elaborately the argument about Monell not applying to private corporations. Judge Hamilton did a better job than I did, but it was in the brief, and appellee chose not to respond to it, saying, oh, this is frivolous. The well-reasoned decisions that the appellee relies on are one that says that was a pre-Monell decision, and the other was a post-Monell decision, which said, well, we're following Monell. Let me go back to the important question about the E and what the record shows. At page 10 of our brief, we cite to the Workman Dep at page 35, lines 23 to 30, 36, I think probably 26, probably a typo, where Dr. Workman said that an E indicates an error, such as insufficient blood, incorrect insertion of the stick in the machine, or some problem with the machine. The idea that, well, it's user error and the next user won't get the E, is not without any support in this record. The appellee made a compelling argument about why the 2-622 argument wasn't raised before the district judge, about that counsel knew what the district judge would rule, that he would probably be offended that somebody's asking him to reconsider his ruling. And then the final point is about Seroquel. The decision to discontinue Seroquel was not made by a doctor. It wasn't made by a psychiatrist. It wasn't made by a registered nurse. It wasn't made by a physician's assistant. It was made by somebody with a master's degree who doesn't have any training, licensure, or education about discontinuing medication. To come up here now and say, well, maybe they discontinued the medication because they didn't want to interfere with her diabetes, is far-fetched.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Thank you, both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.